The date is June 27, 1986. Dr. Stephanie Hillert is out of town, and this is a substitute lecture by Roger Weir on the subject Mysterium Coniunctionis. The tape will begin after a brief pause.
How about a title? We're talking about Mysterium Coniunctionis. We're going to try to talk about it. I can talk about it, but I can't spell it. All these notes in here are the beautiful lecture I would give were I capable of giving it. But I'm not going to be able to get to all that, so I have to select. So if I seem like I'm extemporizing from time to time, it's because I am. And I think we should start. Our beloved friend and bishop is in Iceland, and I think they must be about 7 hours ahead of us. So he's probably drinking by the glaciers thinking of us. Very few people can talk about Carl Jung with understanding, and Stefan is one of the few. I don't have anywhere near the background that Stefan has, and I wish that he were here to give this lecture, but I'll try to do my best with this. Mysterium Coniunctionis is difficult. Jung was 80 when he finished Mysterium Coniunctionis. And when a man like that is 80 years old, he's 2 million. And if you're familiar with Miguel Serrano's wonderful book on the last couple of days of Jung's life, even at 86, he was stomping around with a wizard's hat on and his pipe sparks flowing out, and he was reading Teilhard de Chardin's Phenomenon of Man. So he was a live wire. So when we think of 80, we have to think of somebody who's still storming around. And Mysterium Coniunctionis takes a complete cross-section of all of his work for some 50 years and brings all of the themes together. But instead of being symphonic in structure, Mysterium Coniunctionis is rather like a Wagnerian opera, and you have to get some of the voices in there and hear some of the arias in order to appreciate this grand excursion. But while he was writing Mysterium Coniunctionis, he was also reconsidering his life. And at the very end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, a point that is generally not noticed about Jung or in his character, but Uncle Carl brings it out. And he says in here, at the very end of his autobiography, at this point the fact forces itself on my attention that besides the field of reflection, there is another equally broad, if not broader, area in which rational understanding and rational modes of representation find scarcely anything they are able to grasp. This is the realm of Eros. In classical times, which when such things were properly understood, Eros was considered a god whose divinity transcended our human limits and who therefore could neither be comprehended nor represented in any way. And Jung then brings out the consideration that Eros, in this understanding, is a cosmogonos, a world creator or a universe creator, and that Eros is on a par in this capacity with the Logos, and that most of Jung's writings, most of his work, was on the horizon of the Logos. What thought and what feeling could represent, could talk about, could style? And these are the rational functions thinking and feeling. But crossing them in a perpendicular fashion that's almost like a plummet of mysteriousness is a whole other range, which are not rational and are polarized somewhat in the functions of sensation and intuition. And Eros belongs to this. Eros belongs to that verticality of the irrational. You wonder how I keep my attention? You have to focus on the inside. We are used to understanding in a rational mode through thinking and feeling and having difficulties with that. But we transpose from rationality all of the comportments which are natural to them in this horizon of understanding. We try to project those onto Eros, and we fail utterly, because Eros will have none of it. Eros is a vertical waterfall of mysteriousness, and none of the structures of thought or feeling will cling to it. They have nowhere to hold, and they slide off, and it is mysteriously what it will be. And so it is irrational in that sense that it cannot be stylized. The problem that Jung delineates so magisterially in Mysterium Cunnilinctionis is that in order for us to be whole, we have to not only be rational, but we have to be irrational. We have to be at home in an irrationality which is ours also. But we cannot recognize it as our own initially. In fact, we do everything we can to reject it, to say this does not belong. Even in the teeth of, in the face of, erotic experiences which carry us away and disclose to us incredible insights about ourselves, and eventually, the next day, the next week, a year, 10 years down the line, we have tried to cage this in rationality, put it into perspective, feel our way through this. They were such and so, and I was such and so, and that's that. But it's a fiction. It is a fiction because it is not real. And the self, in bringing together the rational and irrational functions, becomes insistent upon truth and honesty. And for there to be a cunnilinctio, it has to be mysterious. And this is where consciousness always balks, of its own nature balks. Doesn't want to do it. No, anything but this. Anything but committing oneself as known in total to the mysteriousness of oneself as completely unknown in total. And so this is irreconcilable by its nature, by its structure, and one might even say by its design. So that the only traction that we have toward a cunnilinctio, the only beginning that we have, is chaos. It's only in a mixed up series where persons, situations, and events are somewhat understandable, but understandable to the point to where they don't quite mesh into a whole pattern, and this is a chaos. What is difficult for us in our time is that this cunnilinctio becomes almost impossible given our diehard prejudice against irrationality being true. And so it is characterized as unconscious, and is largely unconscious. And yet paradoxically, because the paradox is always there, in order for consciousness to refresh itself, it must always return back to the unconscious. Jung says, we are faced with an incredible fact every day. We have to go to sleep. That consciousness, priding itself on being a blazing sun of understanding, every day goes to sleep. Or if it doesn't sleep today, it'll sleep a long time tomorrow. So that consciousness is diurnal. This is a basic fact. It is not only a physiological fact, but a psychic fact, which looms structurally larger and larger. Right in the middle of Mysterium Cunnilunctionis, in section 4, where he's talking about Rex and Regina, king and queen, which are prefigurations of the Cunnilunctio. And he writes here that the apotheosis of the king, the highest divinized ultimate exfoliation of the king symbol, the renewed rising of the sun, the renewed rising of the sun. This image in Egyptian lore was Horus, the eye of Horus, the newly risen sun. The sun that had made its journey across the sky, had penetrated the horizon, had made its journey through the netherworld, and was able to re-penetrate the horizon and rise. And when the full disk had risen above the horizontal level, then the verticality began again. And that beginning, that was Horus. And this is the apotheosis of the king, is that sun newly risen. And that symbol indicates a new dominant in consciousness. The most in-depth understanding of that symbol is that there is a new dominant in consciousness. That this new dominant, as Jung writes, has been produced. Extraordinary word, penetrating, produced, has not occurred just as a happening because the universe wanted to rearrange your life or some other glib New Age formulation, but has been produced. That this new psychic dominant indicates that the structure of the psyche is extraordinarily dynamic. It's not a nice, comfortable postcard from heaven. It's dynamic, changes, has a dynamic to it. And that in the structure of the psyche, from time to time, dominants that were there lose power and begin to fade. And as they begin to fade, the unconscious begins to fill in where this dominant had once held sway, and new factors come into being, and finally there is a time where the old dominant, like an old king, must be killed. It must die. It must go. It must be replaced for a new dominant to come. Not only does this happen, Jung says, being produced and that the psychic potential then is reversed, so that the flow of meaning temporarily is reversed from the old dominant to the new, but the new is nascent and just begins to rise, and that's the king. But before there's a king, before it rises, the flow of meaning goes to the irrational, to the unconscious, just before that happens. Not only does this happen for the individual, but one of Jung's enormously important discoveries is that this happens for the human race. It happens for civilizations. It happens in a collective way. And again, in Rex and Regina, page 362 of Mysterium Cunnilunctionis, he writes, just as the decay of the conscious dominant is followed by an eruption of chaos in the individual, so also in the case of the masses. Peasant wars, French Revolution, etc., and the furious conflict of elements in the individual psyche is reflected in the unleashing of primeval bloodthirstiness and lust for murder on a collective scale. This is the sickness so vividly described in the Cantilena. The Cantilena is a long alchemical document by George Ripley, who lived in the 15th century in England and was famous for the Ripley Scroll of alchemy. And Mr. Hall has a copy, a first-rate color copy, about 15 feet long, of the Ripley Scroll. The loss of the eternal images is, in truth, no light matter for the man of discernment. But since there are infinitely many more men of no discernment, nobody apparently notices that the truth expressed by the dogma has vanished in a cloud of fog, and nobody seems to miss anything, that is to say, for a while. That just in the case of an individual who begins to lose that psychic dominant which had constellated the integrity in that personality and is going through a transformation, a change in life perhaps, some major happening, some major event, thinks, well, I'm getting used to life. I'm not interested in the old things anymore. I don't need to go hear Dr. Heller every week. Once a year is just enough. Those are danger signs, not only for Dr. Heller's impoverishment, but for your own sense that these concerns are no longer energized enough, charged enough to be of interest. Why is that? Why are we not interested? And so this same condition occurs in civilizations, is in fact occurring in our civilization at the present time. Jung writes, "The undiscerning miss nothing and only discover afterwards in the papers, much too late, the alarming symptoms that have now become real in the outside world because they were not perceived before inside, in oneself, just as the presence of the eternal images was not noticed. If they had been, a therony for the lost god would have arisen as once before in antiquity at the death of the great god Pan." This is an allusion to Plutarch. In Plutarch's large work, the Moralia, he recounts how a crew leaving from Greece, from one of the sacramental areas of Greece, in Arcadia, it was dedicated to Zeus at one time, connected with Olympia, and they were sailing across to the boot of Italy, and they were asked by an old priest to declaim, to shout from the ship as they passed this wooded cape near Tarentum, to shout that the great god Pan had died, was dead. And Plutarch relates that the captain and the crew had shouted this, and that they had heard from the barren hillsides, the mysteriously empty forest, a great moan that went up through the landscape. And of course they landed to search and they found that no one was there. But when a god dies, the earth mourns for that. And in our time a god has died, and the earth is mourning. And Jung says, "Instead, all well-meaning people assure us that one has only to believe that he is still there, which merely adds stupidity to unconsciousness." This is where the do-gooders come in. Oh, it's all right. Nothing has happened. A couple of world wars and a nuclear standoff. It's normal. Boys will be boys. "Once the symptoms are really outside," writes Jung, "in some form of socio-political insanity, it is impossible to convince anybody that the conflict is in the psyche of every individual, since he is now quite sure where his enemy is." There they are. Those are the bad people. "Then the conflict which remains is an intrapsychic phenomenon in the mind of the discerning person, takes place on the plane of projection in the form of political tension and murderous violence. And to produce such consequences, the individual must have been thoroughly indoctrinated with the insignificance and worthlessness of his psyche and of psychology in general." And of course, we're getting this indoctrination all the time now. The psyche isn't real. The eternal images are not real. One can adjust to this. Just go down to the health spas and keep your body muscular and in good shape and keep associating with up people and everything is going to be all right, isn't it? But it isn't. It's unfortunate. And so Jung, right in the middle here of Mysterium Kaniunctionis, tells us at 80 years old, only the living presence of the eternal images can lend the human psyche a dignity which makes it morally possible for a man to stand by his own soul. It's only by allowing the eternal images to have veracity in oneself that one can stand by one's own soul. And it's only by that commitment, then, that that enormous transformation, amounting almost to a transfiguration, of the Mysterium Kaniunctionis can occur. Because it is such a subtle, high-powered action requiring everything, 100%, that if we do not remain committed, the alchemical vessel, which is our integrity, will not hold. It will leak in the form of coughing out, in the form of becoming momentarily disinterested. I'll do that next month. But the difficulty is that there are phases and stages of the Kaniunctio where the energy rises asymptotically and there is no time. There literally is no time. Then if one cannot dance before the Lord with all one's might, one finds that one is smashed royally. Now, if we can come back to his beginning, at the very beginning, Jung is trying to work towards this fulcrum that we have started with tonight. And in the first section, the very first section, the components of the Kaniunctio, and the first designation is the opposites. And we have to understand, he says, that we're dealing here with opposites. We're dealing with polarities, that the psyche is polarized, that it is energized and polarized. We have a great deal of difficulty with this from two complementary standpoints. One of them, from the spiritual standpoint, we understand intuitively that a unity is not polarized, and this is so pneumatically, that a unity is not polarized. And to confirm this, we look at the world of multiplicity, and we see that the world of multiplicity indeed shows a lot more variety than what a simple polarity would allow to exfoliate. And so spirit and body have difficult comportments to the psyche, each from their own standpoint. But the psyche, in its horizon, is polarized. And so Jung lays down an incredible array of opposites for us. East and West, living and dead, masculine, feminine, etc., etc. And he goes into this and brings out that the opposites, in coming out of their polarization, tend to come in pairs together and make a quaternary. And that this is the structuring. That it's not so much that two opposites, two polarities come together, but that it's a pair of opposites that come together into a quaternary. And in this quaternary, Jung gives us some of the basic qualities, the combination of the four elements, the combination of the two manifest elements, the water and the earth, and the two occult elements, air and fire. And most of us are familiar here. And then he goes into the double quaternary, which is the Ogdo, so that one has not only the elements, one would have then, along with that cross, the X of the moist and dry, the cold and the heat. And this would then be the ogdode. The double quaternario, or the ogdode, stands for a totality, for something that is at once heavenly and earthly, spiritual or corporeal, and is found in the Indian Ocean. The father of all. And so Jung goes on with the listing of the components of the Kuniyungtyo, and then, and I'm having to rush now in order to get the structure in, and then in the second part he comes to the paradoxia, the arcane substance and the point. And he will relate in here the philosopher's stone, the one and the all. He writes of the eye like the sun, is a symbol as well as an allegory of consciousness. In alchemy, the scintillae are put together and form the gold. In the Gnostic systems, the atoms of light are reintegrated, so that the point, the scintilla, the point, the point of light, and that point of light also then is related to the multiplicity of the all, the one and the all. He gives us in the Paradoxia a tremendous parable of the Enigma of Bologna, which I'm going to have to skip over because we are going to get caught into this, and come to the third part. After the listing of the opposites, the beginning of that, and then the presentation of the paradoxia. That is, there are polarities, and then there is a special polarity of one and all, which is paradoxical. And it's in this paradoxical opposition of the one and the all that one begins to get an indication of the ability for polarity to transform itself into complementarity. Then, having established that, in the third section, Jung goes into the personification of the opposites. Notice now that once the empirical idea has been introduced psychologically, then one can deal not only with the loggerhead capacity of polarities, but there is a special polarity which allows for a complementarity to occur. Then we go into the personification of the opposites. Now they're going to acquire, as Jung writes, the alchemist's endeavors to unite the opposites culminate in the chemical marriage, the supreme act of union, in which the work reaches its consummation. And after the hostility of the four elements has been overcome, there has to be that initial hostility. That's part of the nature of the polarity. They not only attract, but they repel. But the repelling and the attracting is balanced out. It's energized equal as in an equation, so that the psyche has an equivalency, has an equational aspect to it all the time, which needs to have balance. And that if the imbalance goes to a level which is deeper than the structure can hold, then there is a block that ensues. Instead of a compensatory action, there's a blocking. And this is the beginning of a neurotic situation. But here, after the hostility of the four elements has been overcome, there still remains the last and most formidable opposition, which the alchemist expressed very aptly in the relationship between male and female. Very special situation. That initially, masculine and feminine is indeed a polarity. But after the paradoxical transformation, there is then such a thing as male and female, which are able to be reconciled. And this is the elements in the Mysterium Kuniyungtionis. We are, writes Jung, we are inclined to think of this primarily as the power of love, of passion, which drives the two opposite poles together, forgetting that such a vehement attraction is needed only when an equally strong resistance keeps them apart. So that their quality as polarities is still there. Yes, there is the attraction. What is the attraction? The attraction is the eros, the irrational eros. What is the resistance? The logos, the rationality. Ah, this is sweet. Ah, yes, but what does it mean? What does this forebode? Oh, well, I shouldn't think of so many things. I will commit. But then what will happen? And so you can see the psyche vying back and forth between rationality and irrationality. Not irrationality as insanity, but as a structure. Intuition and sensation, vis-a-vis thinking and feeling. So that the conjunctio then has these two pairs, the rational and the irrational, and this quaternary trying to come into focus here. Alchemy will be the key for Jung as to how this conjunctio happens. I'm having to skip over here. In the page 106 in Mysterium Conjunctionis, in the course of our inquiry, we have often seen that despite the complete absence of any psychology, the alchemical projections sketch a picture of certain fundamental psychological facts and, as it were, reflect them in matter. Why do we need this reflection in matter? Because our only beginning point for this reconciliation, even though all of the elements are there and we're understanding that, or we're understanding as well as intuiting that, we're still in a chaos. So the projecting out onto matter is a necessary action in this. It's a lifesaver for this. So we're going to try to understand this, and this is where the alchemy comes in. We see them reflected in matter. One of these fundamental facts is the primary pair of opposites, consciousness and unconsciousness, whose symbols are Sol and Luna, the sun and the moon. But not just the sun and the moon, but Sol. See, it's personified, and Luna, personified. They have faces. Always in alchemy, you see that the sun and the moon have faces. They're personified, because now we're dealing not just with masculine, feminine, but male and female. But consciousness and unconsciousness, also here. We know well enough that the unconscious appears personified, and that mostly it is the anima, who in singular or plural form represents the collective unconscious. And this, of course, is being written with a man's psyche. From the standpoint of a woman's psyche, it would be the animus. He writes, the personal unconscious is personified by the shadow. And of course, it's the shadow, it's the first engagement in this chaos. More rarely, or sometimes, the collective unconscious is personified as a wise old man. And he gives us the note here that he's speaking here only of masculine psychology, which alone can be compared with that of the alchemist. It is still rarer for Luna to represent the nocturnal side of the psyche in dreams. But in the products of active imagination, the symbol of the moon appears much more often, as does the sun, which represents the luminous realm of the psyche and our diurnal consciousness. The modern unconscious has little use for sun and moon as dream symbols. Illumination can be expressed just as well or even better in modern dreams by electric lights or something on that order. For this to happen, there needs to be a matrix. And the matrix is the ego, this arcane substance. Jung writes, although the alchemist came very close to realizing that the ego was the mysteriously elusive arcane substance and the longed-for lapis, they were not aware that with their sun symbol, they were establishing an intimate connection between God and the ego. As already remarked, projection is not a voluntary act. It is a natural phenomenon beyond the interference of the conscious mind and peculiar to the nature of the human psyche. If, therefore, it is this nature that produces the sun symbol, nature herself is expressing an identity of God and ego. In that case, only unconscious nature can be accused of blasphemy, but not the man who is its victim. It is the rooted conviction of the West that God and ego are worlds apart. But in India, on the other hand, their identity is taken as self-evident. And then Jung goes into this and begins then an investigation of, in the personification of the opposites, of the elements in alchemy. Sulfur, and sulfur would be able to be thought of as close to the thinking function, just as salt is very close to the feeling function. So that sulfur and salt have a relationship. They're in the same horizon of relationality. And what cuts and plummets there through that rational horizon, which salt and sulfur symbolize, is mercury. And the mercurial column is, of course, one has to put mercury above and below. The whole column is mercurial. He goes into the symbols and significance of sulfur and salt, of Sol and Luna, and writes here, interestingly enough, of the way in which a man's consciousness is very sun-like, but a woman's consciousness very moon-like. And that in the phases of the moon, one can see in a woman's consciousness that there is, at the beginning of this cycle, at the new moon cycle, a very precarious and dangerous and unsettling quality to feminine consciousness. And that new moon phase in the feminine consciousness, quite a problem for man, is in fact a problem for man. Man's thought and feeling balk at accepting that as a necessary part of that psyche, sees that as obfuscation, as unnecessary mysteriousness. This is just, you're complicating the issue, when it is not complicating the issue at all, but is a necessary component, without which there would not be the completeness. So that here he writes, page 155, here the connection with the moon tells us that the dark, dangerous, rabid dog changes into an eagle at the time of the plenilunum. His darkness disappears and he becomes a solar animal. We may therefore assume that his sickness was at its worst at the novilunium, at the new moon. It is clear that this refers to a psychic disturbance which at one stage also infected the infant hermaphrodite in this example. In this darkness, there is a thief. The thief in our text is armed with all evil, but in reality, it is merely the ego with its shadow, where the abysmal depths of human nature begins to appear. Increasing psychological insight hinders the projection of the shadow, and this gain in knowledge logically leads to the problem of the union of opposites. The confrontation, the engagement of the shadow, the prelude of this whole integration. Luna, therefore, is not only a changing light, but has a phase in the changing light where it is dark, and that has to be accepted and worked in, and the sun-like, steady nature of masculine consciousness has great problem with this. So that the new moon is dangerous. We have treated at some length the sinister and dangerous aspect of the new moon. In this phase, the climax of the moon's waning, which in folklore is not always considered auspicious, is reached. And even the light of the moon is dangerous, as it causes moon sickness, which comes from the moon wolf. The marriage bred, pregnant women, small children should be protected from this moonlight. Whoever sows by moonlight sows the winding sheet, and so on. And Uncle Carl goes into 8 million examples, which he loves to do through from literature and from his Swiss peasant life. And so the personification of opposites goes this way. And finally we come to a formulation here. Logos and Eros, as we began tonight. Logos and Eros are intellectually formulated intuitive equivalents of the archetypal images of Sol and Luna. In my view, the two luminaries are so descriptive, so superlatively graphic in their implications, that I would prefer them to the more pedestrian terms Logos and Eros. So Sol and Luna. Sol, being masculine consciousness, also personifies then feminine unconsciousness. And Luna, personifying masculine unconsciousness. That part of the problem that is here in the reconciliation, in the Kaniyunktio, one as an individual must face one's own psyche, one's own unconsciousness, before there can be any possibility of a meeting ground. And the first thing one faces in that, of course, is the shadow coming up. Well, we're a third of the way through. We've got to fudge. Let's leave part three and come to part four, Rex and Regina, again, before we drive more people out of the door. Is this too difficult? Is it incomprehensible? I guess we should not go into the dark side of the king. The true man, the anthropos, the true man expresses the whole human being. The man in the individual would mean, it is feared, a scattering of the flock. This would be a retrograde step, but it cannot be blamed on the true man. So we have a discrimination here. And of course the discrimination is able to be understood only in terms of rationality, only in terms of thought and feeling. Intuition and sensation would not make this discrimination between man and true man. And this gives us a problem. If the adept experiences his own self, the true man in his work, then as the passage from the Aquarium Sapientum, the wisdom water vehicle, shows, he encounters the analogy of the true man in a new and direct form and recognizes in the transformation in which he himself is involved a similarity to the passion of Christ is what he is talking about here. But it is not an imitation of Christ, but its exact opposite, an assimilation of the Christ image to his own self, which is the true man. This is a real problem. It's a problem because the rational functions at this point would love to understand that one is imitating the model, imitating and therefore being dutiful to the archetype, and that everything is going to be all right by just following the guidelines. And this, of course, is exactly the pratfall. This is where the subtle fall really comes in. The paradox of the fortunate fall, it's called, comes in, because you cannot imitate it. And this is where one must shift from thinking and feeling to the so-called irrational, mercurial intuition sensation. One must give oneself over to it fully and not imitate anything, but to be that. But the difficulty there is to try to identify outside of oneself the model, not only in the exterior world, but in one's mind. Here's the model in one's mind. or in one's feelings. This feels like it's going right. One must turn away from that at this point, so that instead of imitation, its exact opposite, because you're dealing with polarities here, it's a psychic energy, psychic expression, an assimilation of the Christ image to one's own self, which is the true man. It is no longer an effort, an intentional straining after imitation, but rather an involuntary experience of the reality presented in sacred legend. The effortlessness is there. The confirmation of grace is in that. Not that one has followed the model dutifully. There's no grace in that ever. But that one is that. Without effort, there's the grace. Jung, incidentally, would have been quite a great theologian. He makes clear some of these elements that are almost lost sight of in most of the religious writings. I'm going to have to skip over now that whole section that I began with tonight, the importance of why we need to do this. Why do we need to do this? For our wholeness. Not only because it's a good idea, but we are almost compelled, as it were, to finish this work. And that the work is not only the individual, but then it reflects itself in the civilization at large. He ends up Rex in Regina. The psychological union of opposites is an intuitive idea. That is, the whole expectation of a union of opposites is not a well thought out plan. It's not a well felt integration. The thinking and the feeling must be brought in, but it's intuition that carries the load of that. As a matter of fact, as some of you who were there Wednesday night might remember, that introverted intuition, that attitude and that function, is the pilot light, the key in that, because it's the only way in which that, which the self rather than the ego is able to accept the image of that kunayunktio coming in. And that the image is not a reflection from something outside, but is made, is produced alchemically from within. And so there is nothing out there that corresponds to that image. The image is that reality, and that only by the self presenting that to the rest of the functions collected together, only by presenting that does the image then take the form of a mandala, so that the image of the kunayunktio, when it comes into the alchemical vessel and the self projects it out not on the world or on somebody else, but in one's own fullness, it's there that the mandala occurs, quite naturally, without any effort whatsoever. This, of course, is why it is mysterious, because we never understand that wholeness exactly. Therefore, any explanation of what occurs is always a falsification. The meaning that is there is not a meaning that could ever be explained. And that further explanation at this point reduces it, detracts from it, represses it, actually, in a way. For when we say that consciousness and unconsciousness unite, we are saying, in effect, that this process is inconceivable. The unconscious is unconscious, and therefore can neither be grasped nor conceived. And the union of opposites is a transconscious process, and in principle, not amenable to scientific explanation. The marriage must remain the mystery of the queen. The secret of the art is letting it remain the mystery of the queen. It is her royal prerogative that the king may enter. And it's that understanding mutually that seals the marriage. Then Jung goes into a long section on Adam and Eve, taking off from king and queen. He then brings it down to our civilization, our culture, Adam and Eve. And the final section is the conjunction. I'm getting like my good friend Dr. Heller. I get to the juicy part when there's 1 minute left. In order to get away from trying to explain, and yet having to make an attempt to explain, because the thinking function is not only brought in, but is raised to, if I can use a pun, red hot, white hot levels. So thought and feeling have to be given something to do. They can't be muffled. And so what happens instead of explanations, as Jung writes, it is therefore not surprising that the adepts, as we have seen in the previous chapters, now piled up vast numbers of synonyms to express the mysterious nature of the substances. Millions of synonyms. The prima materia is this, 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 and Jung in some of the sections of psychology and alchemy goes page after page. It's the massing of synonyms over and over and over again. This is a sign of a conjunctio coming in. This in itself, this cloud of instead of logos, you see, being just a line of argument or a definitional line of intelligence, now words begin to cloud and mass themselves together. And here's where we understand numinosity. Numinosity. The phenomenal structure of thought becomes numinous, becomes effusive. This kind of volcanic language, this kind of a poetry of numinosity. And this numinosity then begins to have a particular tone towards self-amplification, feeding off itself. This is the sacred fire then beginning. This is to say that they form the nuclei for an aggregate of synonyms, and these synonyms represent the elements to be united as a pair of opposites. And he goes into this. The conjunctio does not always take the form of a direct union, since it needs or occurs in a medium, and only through a medium can the transition take place. And Mercurius is the medium of conjunction. Mercurius is the soul, which is the mediator between body and spirit. And the same is true of the synonyms for Mercurius, green line and aqua permanens, spiritual water, and so on and so on. And the mandala then, coming out of this numinosity then, the order precipitates. And a mandala then symbolizes by its central point, you see the scintilla, the one, now becomes the central point of the mandala. And the all becomes exfoliated in this quaternary structure. And the mandala symbolizes by its central point the ultimate unity of all archetypes, as well as of the multiplicity of the phenomenal world, and is therefore the empirical equivalent of the metaphysical concept of a unus mundus, a one world. The alchemical equivalent is the lapis, and its synonyms in particular, the microcosm. And then Jung goes into the various stages and shows us the two great stages in the conjunctiona. And I think what we need to do is to leave that for you to read and ponder on. I can feel from my voice and from the number of people leaving that we've probably gone as far as we can. And so I think that we'll leave there. We got to page 474, again, the Mysterium Conjunctionis. Enough said, I think.